like sit down and actually understand the skills you've gained. Like that is the benefit of being someone who's actually a career changer, because you have had experience working. You have skills that you actually have no idea that cross, you know, you can bring in into your new career.
Welcome to Money Bites.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Super, super excited. I wanted to have you on because you've had quite a journey. It hasn't been linear. It's been a zigzag, which I love. So wanted to start from the beginning. It sounds like you started your career from the restaurant service industry.
Yes, that'd be correct.
What did you like about it?
Well, I liked it because I was able to interact with people. And I also felt, well, first off, it's a very easy kind of like entry level job, but there's a lot of complexity actually in working any kind of either food industry or customer service facing jobs, or retail also counts. I specifically went into food because I started as a pastry cook. So I actually started with making food with my hands. And so I went to trade school for that and then immediately got a job and started working in the industry right after. And then made a pivot during my time there to also then move into the front of house. So I started to then was a barista, was a bartender, did some serving, and then also became a manager on the floor.
What prompted the switch?
Mainly for me, it was I remember very clearly I was working at a small bakery and I was the morning baker. And the baristas would come in later and they'd set up the front of the shop and they were very closely linked. So in a lot of places, the back of house, so the cooks don't really see the front of house. But because it was such a small little cafe, I literally could just pop around the corner and I could see all the guests and work with the baristas very closely. So I just remembered there was this guy who would always come in every morning at like right when we opened the doors at like 6 a.m. And he would come in, he was a quite elderly man. And the baristas, they knew exactly what he wanted. They would make it all ready for him. And then they would just chat with him. And I could just see it light up his day and make his whole day. And so I realized that front of house position, you really got the ability to like really change someone's day if you had the opportunity. And I really liked and wanted to do that for people.
That's awesome. It sounds like you're a very people-oriented person. Love it. What did you hate about it?
Well, I think any kind of customer service or, you know, any retail job like that, I mean, your schedules usually are not very consistent. You know, when you work an office job, it's very much like 9 to 5, this is your job. But in the service industry, there can be inconsistencies in your schedule. And then, I mean, you always do get difficult people. There are people that they don't have a good day, or they just don't have a good attitude. And there is no, you can't change that. And so you just kind of have to deal with that situation and you have to brush it off at the end of the day. Like you cannot get worked up, or you shouldn't get worked up, I should say, when someone comes in and they just, you know, it's not their day. And no matter how nice you are, you can't change it. And you're just like, okay, you know, got to move on with their day, serve them and keep going forward.
Respect, Emma. That's such a mature attitude. I'm not sure if I'd be able to replicate that if I went into the service industry. That's awesome. Do you mind, at this point in your life, what was the salary range that you were looking at?
Yeah, so obviously at my lowest point when I was a pastry cook, probably looking at like 40,000 a year, maybe 45. I mean, I was hourly. My starting pay was 12 an hour, you know, 7 years ago. So whatever that equates to, 40 hour week. That was my base. And then at the peak of my career, I could have made upwards to 80,000, but because I decided to, my last job in the industry, I decided to work for quite a large company And because of that, I got health insurance and all of these benefits, which don't typically come in the food service industry or the service industry in general. I ended up making about $59,000 at my last managerial job.
Gotcha. Thanks for sharing that. And then kind of sudden, you made a complete pivot. Did that start with the boot camp? Was that right?
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, the pivot actually started because of 2020. So 2020 happened and I was working at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, which is a large institution. I was working in the food and in the food units, which are actually run by Union Square Hospitality, which is a much larger conglomerate run by Danny Myers. And I remembered it was like a Thursday or something, and news had come out that the Metropolitan was closing and all of this. And we were like, I knew we were very shortly behind that, because if large institutions are starting to say we're going to shut our doors for the public, we're very close to follow. And while the food industry in general got hit very hard because we were also in this institution, the next day, my general manager, who was one up above me, was like, yeah, we're closed for the foreseeable future now. So literally the next day after the news of that, we shut our doors as well to the public for safety reasons. And that was kind of the start, because I was like, okay, cool, I'm out of a job. And then watching the news and just seeing how hard hit everything was going to get, you know, we all were kind of optimistic. Everyone thought, oh, it's going to be like 2 weeks, but I could very quickly see that this was going to be much more long-term, and that the service industry specifically was going to get hit really hard. And
they didn't keep you guys on payroll. They just cut you.
So for those on salary, we did get like our next paycheck, I think, or something like that. So like there is no severance in the service industry, at least even for managers, like there's no severance. There's nothing given like that. So they did give us like one more week of pay. And then they also like did extend health insurance until like, I think it was like April or something. We closed in March. So they did offer that. They did extend that. But of course, only for so long could they do that. And then, you know, then they really just like laid people off. And they only kept some of the really high level, like almost considerably in tech, like the C-suites of the company. Mm-hmm. And they were able to stay on. Everyone else got let go.
That must have been super scary.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely uncomfortable. I attempted at the time to also apply to other jobs that were looking for general managers. So smaller companies in a way were actually cutting the lower staff and keeping the managers on and making the managers do the work, because it was just like, cool, I know what I'm going to pay this person and they're just going to do extra work for me. And so there were still manager positions open, but I was struggling to actually get an interview even, because now suddenly the pool was like myself with a lot of really big names and stuff under me, now competing against other people who had like Michelin star names and people, because all of these people just got laid off. Like they just, their doors closed at these places. So my competition became like 20, you know, it was like doubled than when I usually would be interviewing for these positions, and I just couldn't even find anything. So that's when I realized like, yeah, we're going to have to change. Something's going to have to give.
It's so interesting. It sounds so parallel to what the tech industry is going through right now with all the layoffs.
Yeah. Yeah.
and at that point, what prompted you to, the whole scary part, yes, but taking the courage to completely jump to a different role with a different skill set, that's really courage.
Yeah, I mean, I did have design kind of in my peripheral. So before I even decided to invest my career into hospitality, I did go to college for a couple of years to essentially do graphic design, because my father was a graphic designer. Oh. And my father was a fine artist. So literally, I lived and was raised around art and design and those ideas and theories since I was little. So it was always something I was interested in, and I was always dabbling in it when I could, but never took it on as a full-time job, because when I was actually going for graphic design in school, it was so different than what my father was teaching me, and I did not enjoy it the same way that I thought I was going to. And so I just didn't want to pursue it. And also it was at a time where being a graphic designer was also extremely competitive. And I just wanted a job. I just wanted to start working. I was like, I don't want to be searching forever just to start to get experience under my belt. So that's why I initially took that switch. And then my friend went to a boot camp to become a software engineer, which I originally thought was something I was going to potentially do because I taught myself some basic HTML when I was younger. And then I was like, oh, that's cool. But she was the one who presented me. And when she was at the boot camp, said, hey, there's this thing called UX UI design, and I think you'd be really good at it and you would really enjoy it. Why don't you take a look? And so I immediately Googled it and like researched what it was about. And I was sold. when I read the description, I was like, that is everything that I love to do in terms of like art and design. And that makes me really happy. So after that, then I looked up boot camps to kind of figure out, because I knew I wanted to like spearhead the journey. So I know for a lot of people, you know, they don't have the advantages I had. So I was one very lucky. I was still living with my mother at the time, so I did not have to worry about rent or like a roof over my head or my daughter's head. While I did help contribute towards the food bills and other bills, it was a lot less worry because I was not the sole person who was in the house. And I also had the luxury of time. I was laid off. I didn't have a job that I had to, like, I had no job. And I also had the unemployment checks coming in. So because of COVID, we also did, like, a lot of people had some sort of income coming in. And because I was in the position I was in, like, I was able to get those extra checks that were really helpful, which also allowed me to take that time to say, I'm going to dedicate myself in a very short span of period to change my career, get a job in this new industry, and move this way.
That's awesome. I also saw that you coach folks who are looking to enter UX. So also from a coach's perspective and also from a graduate of a bootcamp, what might be your advice on how to vet a good bootcamp?
Yeah, so I think the best way to vet is to understand what you want and what you're looking for out of the experience. So there's a lot of different ways you can learn. There's obviously self-paced courses. You could self-teach yourself with all of like YouTubes and things, or you can do an actually like lecture, show up, attendance, accountability class as well. And I knew for myself personally, I had to have the accountability. I had to have attendance. I needed that to be successful. And so that was the first thing on my list that I knew I had to look for. And then on top of that, for me, it was also understanding that networking and connections and having a community of some sorts was really important to me. And so looking at how does the community aspect work at this boot camp? Like how involved are they? What are they doing? How is this interaction? And I also recommend for vetting that, like, if you can take like a class or a like, you know, one day thing at the place you're interested in, I highly recommend that. I did do that with General Assembly here in New York. I actually took a one day like intro class to UX UI just to kind of get a feeling, one, for what UX UI was, but also to kind of see the school and see if I liked the school, because I knew they were one of the top people on my radar. Ultimately, though, I wasn't as thrilled as I wanted to be with it, even though the teacher was great. And so I found BrainStation, and then I kind of dug a little more deeper into them. Also on the phone calls with their staff, they were really like not salesy is the best way to say. So like, you know, bootcamp at the end of the day and doing schooling, it is, you know, for profit. You know, people want to get these sales, but they were not salesy at all. They were very much like, we want to do what's best for you. Like, we want to see if this is really the right course for you or if it is something else. And that put me at so much ease, understanding that they really do have your best interest of like trying to guide you forward on the best path possible that you're trying to do with your career change, because they know it's not easy.
Looking back as a graduate, was it the right choice, bootcamp?
For me, yeah, 100%. Especially again, because of my learning style, like if I tried to self-teach myself all of this, there's a high chance that I wouldn't have had the portfolio that I had when I came out. There's a high chance, I mean, I wouldn't have had the connections and network that I have now. There are just so many little pieces that if I didn't take that time to invest in myself and take that boot camp, I wouldn't probably be where I am today.
having graduated from a boot camp in the immediate next few months afterwards, was boot camp sort of the jumping pad that you had expected?
It wasn't. I knew going in that it was going to give me connections and community. It gives you the foundations that you need to learn. So a lot of the theory thinking, especially, it has definitely some of the actual UI principles that are necessary. There are rules around the designing for digital interfaces. And that combined, obviously, is what you need to get started in the industry. And the part where I wasn't prepared was obviously the job part is very different. And any boot camp you go to, they will have hopefully career services of some sorts, but because they have to be so generalized, because they are for a multitude of different disciplines, they can help a lot with like the basic structures that you need of like a resume or a LinkedIn, but it goes so much deeper when you actually go into the discipline of like how the interviews really work. How do you brand yourself? How do you want to position yourself? How do you goal set for what you want to do? So I have found that like the career services though was a place that was slightly lacking in terms of that, and not any really fault of their own. It's the fact that like, that's how the structures of school go. They have a lot, you know, you have one department for multitudes of different people, and it is difficult to give that individualized approach to everyone. And at the time it was difficult, a little bit more difficult for me because in the community I was in at that time, they didn't have as much of a US presence. Mm. And so a lot of the kind of leads that they were giving in were for Canada, and I'm not in Canada. And there is a lot of like Canada jobs that do not transfer to the US. It's a little, you can find US jobs that will support Canadians, but it's not as much in reverse. So I had to do a lot of like the job hunting and connecting on my own end and really put my foot forward in the US market.
In that environment though, you mentioned that you were one of the first of your peers to actually land a job. Amazing. What do you think made you stand out?
So I think part of it was that I definitely had a portfolio that was not just the one project. I purposefully was building my portfolio like midway through the course. I was not waiting till the end. And
was this part of the homework curriculum, or this was like on top alpha work that you were doing?
Yeah. So with the bootcamp I went to, which was BrainStation, there is actually a project where you must submit it like on a portfolio, your last piece that you do. So while you have to just submit that link and that development of a portfolio of a case study on a website, I decided to start that earlier and add other pieces along the way that I felt were valuable. So I added a group project, I added a redesign project. So I tried to add other pieces that would set me out there. I also knew personally, like an expertise or an area of interest I had was obviously UI and interaction design. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to try to portray that through my portfolio as well, which also probably aided in that as well.
That's awesome. The hard work, the extra work always pays plays out. And then, so you landed a job as a UI designer. And one thing I noticed was you made quite a lot of jumps in the past few years. Was this intentional?
So part of it was intentional and part of it wasn't. So my first job I ever landed, I intentionally did decide to move on. It was a very, very, very small startup. It was just myself and one other person. So while I got to learn a ton, I did kind of reach that ceiling where I said, I can't really learn anymore without having some sort of other designer or a mentor above me who I could really learn from. Mm. And so I decided to take the leap into the next position. And also healthcare in and of itself, while it was on my top three of industries I would love to work in, it wasn't my top industry. I really wanted to work in food tech. So that was something I had been focusing on since I had started, was like, what companies would I want to work for, networking and connecting with these companies. So the next one after that was Lunchbox that I got to land. And then I also took a contract gig in that first year because I wanted a little more experience and I wanted to put something else on my resume. But it was just a contract. So it was only for like 3 months, 4 months that I worked with these people to do a redesign of their app. Then with Lunchbox, I was with them for about a year and a half. And then unfortunately, with all of the tech things we're seeing right now in 2023, in 2022, I was in that wave of people and I was one of the people laid off at the company. So unfortunately, Lunchbox was just kind of a blessing in disguise because of course I didn't want to get laid off. I didn't want to leave the company, but then of course now I'm at Daily Harvest, which is absolutely amazing to have that experience and be in that realm.
Hooray. Winnie being Winnie, I have to ask, with each of these jumps, both voluntary and involuntary, all with a silver lining, were you actively negotiating and were you making significant salary jumps along the way?
Yeah, so I definitely, from Lunchbox to Daily Harvest, it wasn't as large of a jump, but definitely from my first startup to Lunchbox was definitely a big jump. I went from like 60 to 95 there. So that was my largest jump in salary.
For UX designers, what is the salary range that you can look at?
There's a lot of factors because you do want to kind of look in your area. It always is going to vary company to company. There are companies that will have standards across the board, and there are companies that will base the salary based on where you are located, based on your, you know, living. So in New York City, obviously, it's a much higher cost of living. So more generally for a UX designer, you would probably be looking at around $85,000 on actually the low end as a new person. And then you could go all the way up to probably like $175,000, $185,000, depending on, and that's if you're staying in that like IC track, I think. I don't really know like what happens if you move into the managerial track.
Gotcha. So at Daily Harvest, I also saw that your role name changed to product designer. Is there any difference between a UX UI designer and a product designer?
Yeah, so this is an age old kind of debate. healthy debate within the community. I don't personally think there's a huge difference, but if we had to put what difference would there be, it's mainly that a product designer would weigh in a little bit more of the business side of things versus just strictly the user. So a product designer still very, very much considers a user's journey and user's experience. You are still the biggest advocate for them. But you do, as a product designer, weigh in a little bit more of those business decisions, really try to understand and empathize with what the business needs to do as well. And how do you help get them forward?
Mm. Again, congrats on going into Daily Harvest. Food tech, it seems everything is sort of stars aligning.
Yes.
But also wondering, do you think 3 years, 5 years down the line, product design is still where you'd want to stay?
That's an interesting question. I feel like, yes, I would love to still do it, but maybe potentially part-time if my own business were to take off. So I would ideally love to kind of work on my own business, but I probably will always have a hand in it just because I do really enjoy the cross-collaboration and I do still, you know, it's like continuing to refine your skills and keeping those skills up. So I think that would be my ideal is work part-time still in the industry and then focus on my business more so. Obviously right now I work full-time and the business is more part-time. So kind of do a reversal of roles.
Love it. And it sounds like you already have a business that you've started up.
Yeah. So I just, I've had a few businesses throughout my life. I've been kind of a little serial entrepreneurial in a way since I was a kid. And most recently, I decided I always wanted to have a physical product. I've attempted to do like services and digital products and things like that, but they just didn't, because being a UX, UI designer, product designer, like I live so much in the digital and tech space that to offer something yet again in that field to me just wasn't something I was as passionate about. So I've now started a business where I'm actually doing candles, but we're also looking at the science side of things. So we are making them pet friendly, but they're also pet inspired. So we do have some collections that are obviously pet inspired with the labels and everything. And we also offer like custom candle experiences, which really were started as like pet memorials, but we've had a lot of people come through which with their pets still alive and they just, you know, want a fun candle that smells good, but also like expresses their pup or cat.
What does expressing your pet mean? Like the candle smells like your pet? Or
yeah, we've had that a couple of times. People get confused. So we've kind of changed the tagline to their story, your scent, our memories. So it's their story, meaning you actually name the candle, you add a little description about the candle. And like, so the label itself is all like your kind of wording and your story, like the story you want to tell. And then your scent is obviously actually a nice scent that you would like, that you enjoy, not, you know, wet dog smell or something. And then our memories is the idea really came around the fact that like, I thought in my head here in New York City, obviously, like we don't get fire pits. We don't have fireplaces. Like these don't exist in New York City. And especially in the winter, like I always loved like hygge, which is the Danish word for cozy. And it was a big thing that kind of took off here. And I always liked that sense, but I was like, how do you get that in a New York City apartment? Like, It's so difficult because you can't, you know, you can't really have a fireplace. This doesn't exist here. We don't have fire pits. You know, candles were the way. Candles were the way that I kind of could get that cozy, warm feeling. It is also like when I was with my mom, like we would have candles on the table and that's a communal time together. So we would tell stories. And so it kind of became this way of like, here's a candle you can have, you place it on your table during dinner or during just like cozy time. And you can just have these memories or tell these stories around this candle and have it as like a centerpiece. And then we also just wanted to make them pretty as well, because a lot of candles in the pet industry that are like have pet odor elimination or things like that, which ours also have some of that attribute as well. They're not very aesthetically pleasing. And so we also wanted to take that difference. And that's kind of where the UX UI comes in of like, how do we make this holistic experience where everything is really beautiful and you have this really great experience from start to finish with the end product at your home?
I'm really inspired from your first career in the service industry, how you continue to build upon the skill sets that you gain. Your career seems to have been a zigzag of, you know, different industries, but it's not like random pieces. You're just building and continuing to mold yourself on top of it. I love that.
Yeah. I mean, it felt random to me, to be honest. I agree that like, if you actually sit, which is what I tell a lot of people that I mentor, like sit down and actually understand the skills you've gained. Like that is the benefit of being someone who's actually a career changer, not necessarily someone coming out of college, because you have had experience working. You have skills that you actually have no idea that cross, you know, you can bring in into your new career. And then in your new career, you're going to continue to stack new skills on top of that. And I know that's a big thing that people talk about on like, if ever you wanted to be like an owner or a CEO or own your company, like skill stacking is like the way to actually keep working up, because that's actually how you become, you know, very well-rounded and the ability to understand more things.
I love that. I feel it's also very apropos in a sense that in the tech industry, we've been hearing more and more about ageism. Mm-hmm. But also it's also true that we as a generation are going to be living a lot longer than some of us may have expected. And this career transition actually may not be voluntary, but necessary as our second, third sort of careers to just sustain ourselves. And being able to pivot that into the mindset of a new adventure based off of the skill sets and the experiences that I've already built and am able to contribute to. I love how you're framing that.
Yeah. Well, I think the one thing too in this day and age that I think the thing we always will always know in life is that it always changes. And if you are if it's very difficult for you to experience change or have change, which it is for some, that's something you probably want to work on because it's inevitable in this day and age. I mean, I love hearing my mother's stories, who is 74, and like hearing about her childhood versus my childhood versus seeing my daughter's childhood. Like it's so wildly different, you know? And even with our age gaps, even though I am significantly younger than my mother, mother is significantly older than my daughter. Like, you know, what's the one thing that stayed consistent? Well, things have changed. Like the starting points where people come in and how the world has evolved and how we've adapted to what we need to do and how we act or react to the world is completely changed.
And you really embody that ethos of change in a sense that it's not just the daily harvest. It's not just the physical candle startup that you're building. You have a few additional side adventures. Well, okay, can you share a bit of those?
Yeah. So the other side adventure I have is I do go in and like do public talks with students who are doing career changes, specifically helping and aiding in that jump of landing your first job, which is the most difficult. And I always tell people, like, once you get your foot in the door, it becomes a lot easier after that. But getting your foot in the door, especially after you're like, I just did a boot camp, I'm exhausted. Like, yeah. It can be very disheartening. And so I try to come in and aid as much as I can, give advice, you know, obviously continue to keep it lighthearted because I do still think there's room, but it's also a harsh reality. Like it is, more and more people are trying to get in. Tech is not in a great place right now as things ebbs and flow. How do you get that opportunity to still kind of break through? Because I do think it still exists there. So that's what I try to help people and aid with. But I originally was doing one-on-ones, but I decided that my time was better spent if I could like speak to more people and larger people. And then after, like, people can come up to me and speak to me a little bit one-on-one so I can help them. And then of course people can connect with me on LinkedIn, and I try my best to obviously answer people there when I remember to get on.
Super generous. For folks who are trying to jump into UX UI for the first time in this particular market, any mental tip, any action tip that you might be able to share?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I always tell people is that, I mean, you have to treat it like a job. There's no other way to say it, unfortunately. Like, and by a job, I also do mean block time out. Like, you need to give yourself time that you are enjoying stuff, because it is going to be hard. It's going to be a lot of rejection emails. You're going to feel super defeated at times. So you really need to make sure you also are having things that recharge you, that bring you happiness, that bring you joy at the same time, you know. But the biggest thing is you do have to treat it like a 9-to-5. It isn't like, you know, it's not like, let me do it for a couple hours on the weekend. Like, you're going to have to dedicate time to really, you know, sit down and send those LinkedIn messages out, send those resumes out. I also highly recommend for anybody who's trying to get in the industry is to do portfolio reviews. So you can reach out to either people you know on LinkedIn, or there is the really popular ADP list. I think it's .org or .com. And you can sign up with mentors who actually mention that they do portfolio reviews. And I always recommend people do it just like you would user test. User test your portfolio with people who are in the industry and get feedback, and then build a priority matrix around that and say, like, okay, what was a common theme that a lot of people told me I needed to change? Is that doable that I can do? Yes. And then make the change. That's actually, I did that as well in my first, for my first job. And I immediately saw results. I actually did that user research, did the priority matrix, did some of those changes within my portfolio. And I actually started to get first leads. I wasn't necessarily getting to the end, but I was starting to get those bites where people wanted to get on that first phone call with me. And when you know you get that, again, it's small little steps that will get you closer and closer to that goal. So getting those first bites means that, okay, something worked, people are interested. Now you need to start working on those interviewing skills. And then you learn from those and you continue to build on that, and you just keep building from there. So again, it is building those skills, but you have to build them, you know, again, when the things start happening, you start to be able to experience and learn those skills. And I know I am personally a kinetic learner. So for me, it's almost mandatory that I do things to learn. But I do think in general, as human beings, that we do still, most people will learn the best by doing. And that is why people say as entrepreneurs, you will likely fail many times before you succeed, because you have to learn by failing or by not getting the bites, or like getting the bites and then not getting through the second round, and like learning, okay, what can I do better? Where did I go wrong? And then improve upon that.
This is such a gem of an advice. Thank you for sharing.
Of course.
Switching gears into the personal space a bit. You have quite a lot to juggle right now with three exciting adventures. What would you say for 2023? What are some of your personal financial goals, if you don't mind sharing?
One, get out of debt. So I am unfortunately in debt that accrued mainly from the pandemic era. It accrued from being laid off. Obviously, I was laid off. I did not have a job for about 3 months. It took me about 2-3 months to get a job. It accrued from my daughter, who was one of the pandemic kids. So she really struggled with the whole schooling system and what happened there. And I decided to pull her out and do pretty much, it's like a private accredited online school. So it's significantly cheaper than any private school you could ever go to. But obviously it's not a public school. So I had shelled out money for that when I wasn't really financially prepared to do that. I also did kind of lifestyle inflate, and not to the point where people think I'm rolling around in a Maserati or something, but the fact that New York City is expensive and I moved out of my mother's, that's lifestyle inflation here. Mm-hmm. Because the moment I got more money, I could qualify, and rents were still slightly lower in New York City at that time. They were not as good as they were, but they were still on the lower end. So I took the leap to get my first apartment with my daughter. But of course, we lived alone. So I was sole provider. That kind of set me back. So definitely working on kind of, you know, getting out of debt. That's my big goal. And then probably after that is actually getting a car, because for doing markets and like pop-ups and things that I would want to do with the business, having a mode of transportation like that, even though we do have, you know, public transportation here in New York City, a car is just easier when you have a whole bunch of stuff you need to lug with you somewhere.
For sure. For sure. For the getting out of debt, totally applaud the goal. What's the hardest part about it?
Probably the hardest part is like when you pay off a bunch, but then you still get a little bit back up, even though you know you're going to pay it off. It's like, mm-hmm. like if it's grocery bills, right? Because I still use like my cards for like my actual bills. Like for instance, recently I did pay off one of the cards, but I still put like the grocery bill on it, which is budgeted for, but it like, it feels kind of icky because I'll see it and I'm just like, what? And it like, you know, and then also the hardest part is that it ebbs and flows just like life, right? There are times that I can put down a ton of money and really make a dent. And there's other months that like, I just don't have as much to put down on it. So I'm not making as much progress. And so that can be a little bit deterring, but you know, the idea is that it's like, if as long as I'm still putting it down, it's going lower, like big numbers going lower. That's what matters at the end of the day. But I would say that's the toughest part, is because it does ebbs and flows. Sometimes I can put a bunch down and it feels really good. Other times it's like, I'm not making as much of a dent on the race.
As long as the direction is
exactly
downwards. One question that I might just seed in your head is, if your budget is fairly consistent, so it's not volatile month to month, and it might not be like big chunks every month, but at least you're putting in whatever you've set for yourself on a consistent basis. One thing that you might want to take a look at is if you have a high credit score, or a higher credit score, a zero balance transfer.
Yeah, no, I've heard of it. To be honest, I have been so clueless to how those work. So that'd be great, because I've definitely heard of it, but I've like not ever utilized it. Because I'm like, how does this exactly work? I don't know. I always feel like there's a catch. I'm like, I don't know.
Well, there is a catch in a sense that after the period when the promotion, the zero balance, zero interest period is over, it goes back up.
Yeah.
And also, you shouldn't be spending on that card, that zero balance transfer card. So once you transfer over, like that card should be solely for, I'm going to get rid of this debt.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also there is the caveat also, you need to qualify with your credit score.
Yeah, of course.
and whatnot. Cool. This was fantastic. Last question. For folks who might be interested in connecting with you for either public speaking or for the candles, where can they find you?
Yeah, so for public speaking or anything UX, UI, product design related, LinkedIn is the best place to find me. Just look Emma Sadler up there and you will find me. And then for the company, the best way is actually Instagram. We are Wolfwix Co. on Instagram.
Love it. Love it. Emma, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I'm really happy.